Hi, podcast listeners. This is Doug Fabrizio. So during the month of July, the Radio West Book Club read James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. Baldwin is having something of a renaissance right now. He died in 1987, but his ideas about race and politics and religion seem as fresh and insightful as when he was talking about them as this famous public figure. Go Tell It on the Mountain was Baldwin's first novel. It's a semi-autobiographical work that allowed him to confront and even work through his difficult relationship with his stepfather, a preacher who he reimagined as one of literature's great antagonists. We met recently as a group to talk about the book. Radio West executive producer Christy Miners led the discussion. Our guest was Dr. Justin Joyce. He's co-founding editor and current managing editor of the James Baldwin Review. He also works as the research director for President Dwight A. McBride at the New School. We began the conversation with an overview of James Baldwin's life and work.
Right, so he's born in Harlem in 1924, August 2nd. It only matters because it's like close to my birthday, so I'm always like, oh, right. But yeah, and he's raised by his mother and his stepfather and a growing number of siblings, right? There was a number of children, and he becomes increasingly responsible for them. He's a very bright child. He excels at school. He gains a number of important supporters and mentors. He starts writing at an early age. He writes for a school magazine. And one of the things that comes out rather clearly in this novel is he also joins a Pentecostal church as a child preacher, right? So from 14 to 17, he works as a child preacher, and he has a very, very embittered relationship with his stepfather. His stepfather is a rather strict religious man. He's a Baptist minister. And to say that the two don't get on well is an understatement for sure. And after his stepfather dies, Baldwin at this time is 19, it's 1943, he leaves home and he moves into Greenwich Village. He's exposed to a number of literary circles, a number of Marxist and early socialist circles. And he continues to write, publishing a little bit here and there, reviews. And he also, in the 40s, he meets two really important people in his life. One is Richard Wright, who at the time was the sort of titan of African-American literature, right? And he's an important early figure, and he's also an important figure when Baldwin later breaks from Richard Wright, rather publicly, in an essay that he writes called Everybody's Protest Novel, and it becomes a big spat between the two. And he also meets a man named Buford Delaney, who is a painter. He's openly homosexual, and this is a really important figure for Baldwin. He refers to Delaney as his spiritual father. And he spends a good deal of time in New York trying to sort of find his way, but he gets increasingly disenchanted, upset, frankly, at the racial structure that he's living in. And so in 1948, he leaves New York for Paris. He sort of follows Richard Wright there, who had, you know, expatted himself in 1947. And Baldwin stays in Paris for almost 10 years. He's there until 1957. And his novel comes out, his first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, comes out in 53, right? It took him a long time to write. It was a very difficult book for him. It took him like 10 years and more than one breakdown, like legit nervous mental breakdown, right? He actually finishes the novel while he's on hiatus in this small little village in Switzerland. And when the novel comes out, it's well-received, and he continues to write, and his fame continues to grow, right? His second novel is mixed reception because it's a very definite break. First of all, it's rather frankly an explicitly homosexual novel. Second of all, there are no African-American characters in the novel. So a lot of the people that had championed Go Tell It on the Mountain are just sort of left scratching their head, right? And as Baldwin continues to write, he experiments with a number of different forms. He writes plays, he writes novels, right? He ends up, through his life, he writes six different novels, a whole bunch of different book-length essays. He writes a film treatment based on the life of Malcolm X. He writes a children's story. He does collaborative works. And he really gets known as an essayist in the 1960s, especially with The Fire Next Time, which comes out in 1963. By 1963, James Baldwin is an international celebrity. I mean, he is one of the most photographed, one of the most sought after people, right? He is a talking head right when the talking head first sort of really shows up for primetime television, right? But as the 60s sort of progress, Baldwin gets very, very disheartened and dispirited by what he saw as the failures of the civil rights moment. Not of the movement necessarily, but of the moment, right? So there are several high-profile assassinations, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, all three of these men Baldwin knew and referred to them as his friends. And he is rather famous for saying, "They're murdering my friends." And the election of Nixon, and then you get Reagan, and Baldwin grows increasingly embittered. And he works through this differently in his writings, and a lot really championed him as an early writer, really turn on him at that moment. So his literary reputation is a bit mixed. There was a long time where there was an early Baldwin and a late Baldwin kind of thing. And a lot of people really sort of wrote off the late Baldwin. And I will say that I definitely don't adhere to that critical viewpoint. There's a lot going on in the late Baldwin that is more complicated. It's more experimentally dense. There's a lot of different things, but it's certainly not the case that his writing went down in quality, right? But he continues to write all the way up until he dies. He dies in 1987, he dies of cancer. And his legacy really gets recovered in the mid 90s. There are a number of scholars and a number of critics who are working on looking at James Baldwin and looking at his reputation and trying to get him out of the trap of either being a black writer or a gay writer. Either he's a religious writer or a secular writer. And by the 90s, especially the late 90s, cultural studies has really showed up in the American Academy in a way that the complexity of Baldwin's writing is allowed to be really explored. Right. And so he gets to be a more interesting and multifaceted writer, and he's less pigeonholed in these various places. Last thing I will say is the overview is his sexuality really sort of plagues his reputation for a great deal of his career. Separate from being pigeonholed one way or the other, he also really gets written off by a number of figures in the Black Arts Movement and Black Power, right, because he is openly queer. And that is not working for them in a number of complicated ways, right? And so the resurgence of, like I said, you know, cultural studies in the academy allows us to look at that differently and more generously. And since the late 90s, there has been just an explosion of interest in James Baldwin, and he's more relevant than ever, sometimes for a lot of really depressing ways. That's my quick overview.
That's a very good overview. And we did a show, I think I shared with you, and most of you know, we did this show this last week about the famous debate that he and William F. Buckley did in Cambridge in 1965. And as I was writing the text for the web, I think I actually wrote, he is, you know, disappointingly relevant yet again. And the things he has to say are just as relevant as they were in 1965. And truthfully, I wish that wasn't the case, you know?
So do I.
Yeah.
I've said before, right, it's rewarding and in a way kind of fun to be working on an author and projects on an author who is hot right now.
Yeah,
but right. I'd be okay if he wasn't relevant for a while.
Right.
That would be better for all of us.
Right.
But anyway.
Well, one thing I should note that I didn't say at the top is we welcome all discussion. If you have questions, if you have comments that you want to make, things that you notice from the book, things that you've been wondering about, if you have questions for Dr. Joyce, if you want to either unmute yourself and ask him, please do, or throw him in the Slack channel. But so if you have anything you want to contribute, we'd love to hear it. But one thing I wanted to go back to that you mentioned was that it took him 10 years to write Go Tell It on the Mountain, that he was almost paralyzed by this, especially near the end. He just couldn't seem to finish it. What was it that was, I mean, this was a first novel. This was a man who was a writer. So he knew how to put words together. He knew how, you know, what was it that was so paralyzing to him about this particular book, and why did he struggle trying to finish it?
Well, There's a couple answers to that. And the sort of pedestrian answer is an important one. So we'll start with that one. His understanding of religion and spirituality and sexuality was something that was going to be hard to publish, right? So there are certainly some homoerotic moments in Go Tell It on the Mountain as we see it today, right? But the early drafts of the novel and the early short stories that eventually get published later are way, way more explicit. So he well knows that this is going to be a problem. And so he's trying to come to a way of being able to keep that, but also sublimate it in a way, right? So that's one thing, and it needs to be talked about. But the more complicated and somewhat more interesting thing is he is really struggling with his heritage, both in terms of his own life, right? The fact that he is raised by a man who is not his father. He does not know and never knows the identity of his biological father. And so this feeling of being, you know, forgive the term, but being a bastard child really haunts him. And on top of that, he is struggling very much with being an African-American writer and being pigeonholed as an African-American writer. He wants to be a writer. He doesn't want to be a Black writer. And that is a tension that he has to deal with his entire life. And he's very conscious of that, even in the moments of trying to get his first novel out, right? And then the final thing is that coming to terms with his own identity really means coming to terms with his relationship with his stepfather. And this is a relationship that, I mean, really tormented him. And he wants to treat it, he wants to have that material there, but this is very painful material. And it's tough. It takes him a long time to get it out. And by the time he does, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but I mean, he actually does this in this tiny little remote village in Switzerland. Way far removed geographically and temporally. I mean, we're more than 15, 20 years from his childhood by the time he's writing this in this small village. He writes a number of really important essays about that experience, right? But he kind of needs to go really far away in order to be able to return to that imaginative space and fill it out. I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Doug, you wanted to chime in here.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question, and forgive me that you can't see me. I'm having problems with my camera, so I'll be a disembodied voice. Dr. Joyce, thanks again for doing this. This was along the lines of what you were talking about just a moment ago, and it was something that came up in our conversation about Baldwin, and that is that when he was writing that book, Go Tell It on the Mountain, he didn't want it to fall into what he described as protest fiction. What did he mean by that? If you understand the term.
Yeah, for sure. So that was the essay that I alluded to earlier. His sort of public break with Richard Wright. So Richard Wright was an important figure. He helped him get some funding, and he helped him when he first showed up in Paris. And yet, one of the really important essays he writes is called "Everybody's Protest Novel." And in that essay, James Baldwin takes Richard Wright to task, because Richard Wright's main novel is too sentimental for Baldwin, and it doesn't really get to the complexities of what it would really mean to deal with race and deal with sexuality in all these various ways. And so the protest novel for Baldwin is this sort of flat, stock character, pull at the heartstrings kind of novel. And Baldwin really does not want to do that, right? And the comparison he makes between Wright is Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I mean, this is just sort of a devastating comparison. And Baldwin didn't really see it that way, but certainly everybody else took it that way. And James Baldwin really, really did not want to be writing that kind of tug at the heartstrings sentimental novel.
Right? Was that a literary distinction for him, or was there also something that he saw in the racial experience that was far more complex than what he was seeing, or was it all of those things?
It was both.
Yeah, okay.
It was both, certainly. I mean, right, the sort of protest novel and the sort of, I mean, one way to put it would be that the protest novel, these are not his terms, but it could be the propaganda novel, right? you're really trying to only train a lens onto a certain problem. And that's all you're working on. And for Baldwin, it was always, look, all these things are complicated. They always have a history and they're always interrelated. And to just point it in one direction really simplifies things in a way that is not useful and not helpful. And we want fully fleshed out complex characters and complex plots and things like that. So it is an aesthetic or, you know, literary distinction, but for Baldwin, those matter in the world and the social issues that you're treating in that novel. Otherwise, it's not good fiction to begin with. One of his big literary heroes was Henry James, right? Really working on the American realist novels tradition. And so he wants to be able to write these high modernist realist novels, but yet he doesn't want them to be sentimental. I don't know if that gets to...
Absolutely. I'll step away and let other people ask questions. But it just comes to mind, this was one of the things that I was thinking about in that debate that we talked about last week, was Baldwin did not have a simplistic view of how to, where racism originates, how to solve it. He talked about it as this deeply complicated thing. And it's just interesting to see his ideas about race converge with his complicated, nuanced ideas about literature. That's really, it's kind of fun to see those connections.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's one of the reasons that he was a really, really successful writer, really good at it, right? I mean, I'm not trying to be, you know, silly about saying that, but it takes a ton of talent to be able to do that and do it well.
And I think correlated to that is something that really has struck me about the novel whenever I've read it is, unlike, I suppose, a lot of that, the protest literature that Doug is talking about, and even I think more recent works like the film 12 Years a Slave and so on, this is a novel that's in which white people are almost entirely absent. You know, it is deeply infused, I think, with race, of course. You know, it cannot not be, but it's a much more internal novel than it is a political novel. It's about John, about what's going on in John's head, about these characters and their struggles. So it's not stuck in that sense, right? It replicate you know, the trials of Jim Crow or anything like that in the lives of these characters. It's about them as people more than it is about them, you know, as figures in a sort of social play.
Just before you get into this, I noticed I found this quote. I was reading this New Yorker article, and a quote that they quote James Baldwin. He was speaking with Studs Terkel. I'm sure you've read this, Dr. Joyce, but he makes a comment about why it was so hard for him to write Go Tell It on the Mountain. And he said, I was ashamed of the life in the Negro church, ashamed of my father, ashamed of the blues, ashamed of jazz, and of course, ashamed of watermelon. All of those stereotypes that the country inflicts on Negroes, that we all eat watermelon, that we do nothing but sing the blues. I was afraid of all of that, and I ran from it. I think this is what Matt's getting at here. Is that this is an internal, it's the racism that has been imposed and that sits inside rather than, like, you know, we talk about these sort of traditional protest movements or things like that. I when I read that quote, it really hit me. I just thought, oh, the shame that he's feeling that's imposed upon him by the structure that he lives in.
Yeah, and I mean, just, I'm super glad it didn't work out this way, but I mean, what would have made Go Tell It on the Mountain a sort of sentimental protest novel as Baldwin would have imagined it is if the Grimes family was beset by a white landlord that was hounding them for money all the time. Just that one character, right? That would have changed the entire dynamic of the novel, of the development, of the structure of feeling that's created for the reader, right? And so to be able to have that inner complexity without the obvious villain is really quite a feat. I mean, it's an artistic achievement for a reason, right? Like,
one of the things that we talked about a fair amount online is, and you know, I know this is sort of jumping ahead, but the ending of the book came as a surprise to, I think, a lot of us who hadn't read it before. Knowing that Baldwin had left the church when he got older, I was shocked that it ends with John's conversion and him becoming what seems like very institutionalized within the church. Can you talk a little bit about the ending of that book and what Baldwin was working through with writing The Threshing Floor?
For sure. I mean, I could try. I don't know that I should have been so confident, right? So one of the things that's important, I think, in my reading of the novel is that a good deal of the way that religion is treated is quite literal in a realist sort of novel tradition, but it's also metaphorical, right? He is moving through history. He is moving through the struggles of his family and his ancestry. And they are wrapped in this spirituality, and so is he, right? And so he is part of it. And for him to be having this conversion scene and to be saved is a way for him to finally accept that history, right? To piggyback off the other quote that you had shared, Christy, it's a moment for him to own it without so much shame, right? And so certainly, I mean, you can't deny that the way the novel is set, he says, you know, I'm ready, I'm coming. It's okay, he's gonna go back into his stepfather's house. But he, James Baldwin, you know, there was an interview right after the Go Tell It on the Mountain came out, and he's said that, I'm paraphrasing here, but when I typed the end on that manuscript, I knew I had come through something. And he's other places he has said that, you know, he had to write about what hurt him most in order to write about anything at all, right? And so if we take that and the autobiographical content of it, right? So Baldwin is a child preacher from 14 to 17. This is a very tightly written novel. The whole thing takes place in one day, right? Even though we have flashback scenes that go back at least two generations, if not more, once you take the grandmother and all that, right? It's still, it only takes one day, and that's when he's 14. And we know from Baldwin's own biography that 3 years later, he will leave this church, and he will never return to the pulpit. But yet he will always have this religious tradition in his writing. I mean, even in the interview that that you were just referring to with Nicholas Bukola, he talked about how in that moment in Cambridge in 1965, Baldwin stands up there and he is there to give a sermon, right? And his writing has those biblical cadences, his rhetoric. I mean, he never really leaves the language of the church, but he certainly leaves the institution, as it were, right? And so there's a way in which the metaphorical content of the novel carries through in that same way. John, he's ready, he's coming, and perhaps he will tarry for a while in that church, but we now get the sense that he is saved and that he knows his identity, right? He knows who he is in this moment, and that's going to allow him to progress through, right? And yeah. I'm going like this only because I don't see any reason not to say, I also, the first time I read the novel, I was, what? After all that, you're going to go with this guy? Like, and but yet, there's a way in which it doesn't have to just end there. Right. And that open ending kind of thing is a bit of a signature, right? Very few of his works end super definitively. That's it, all done. Right. There's a lot of them that there's something more going on. I don't know if that
that's
the blow at all, but
I think it's just such a surprise. You know, I think those of us who hadn't read it we didn't see it coming, you know, especially when you see him. You know, he gets his birthday money, he goes to the movies, you think you know where this is going, you know, he's going to disavow and turn his back on his family and especially his stepfather. We have to talk about Gabriel because he's such a complicated and painful character.
Sure.
But before we do, I did have one question because it's something that we had talked about just internally, Doug and I last week about what Baldwin did retain from his church upbringing. And one of the things that I was wondering about was not so much theological, but his sense of humanity and he had this, we talked about, he truly believed in the power of love, and in a sense that almost feels religious in a way. I don't know, I'm not quite phrasing it right, but if you sort of know what I'm talking about, if you can pick up, Matt, you might know better than what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is kind of the sense of sin, but also I think in a lot of these characters, what you see is maybe, you know, John has the actual literal Pentecostal conversion right at this end, this sort of sense of salvation. But you also see, I think, in a lot of the other characters and throughout a lot of Baldwin's work is this sense of personal transformation. And the ways in which people have kind of these cathartic moments. Like, I think, even if it's not explicitly religious, right, like at the end of the novel, right, Florence has this kind of like moral awakening and decides to confront Gabriel, right? And then this is something I think that many of the characters have at one time or another throughout this novel, but also through his fiction generally. And I suspect there was some kind of Pentecostal inheritance there, or evangelical inheritance there.
What do you think, Dr. Joyce? Do you see echoes in his work of not just in the skills that he obtained from the church, but also some of its teachings as well?
Oh, for sure. And love is an important concept, right? And it comes up a lot for him. And as he develops as a writer and as a public figure, he comes back to it again and again and again, right? Because it is a way of capturing the sentiment of a connection that doesn't necessarily depend on some sort of higher power or institutional sanction, right? So we can be about an ethic of love and love for each other, but we don't necessarily have to go through all the terrible flagellations of the sinful body and all that, right? So he's definitely retains that commitment to a higher calling. And whether or not the higher power stays there, I mean, that's more of a personal question for him, but he certainly, I mean, he's got a rather famous quote, you know, if God can't bring us together and bring us up, well, then maybe it's time to get rid of him, right? I'm paraphrasing again. But I mean, I will say about the love thing, it comes up a lot. And in more recent scholarship on Baldwin, a number of critics are really training their lens on this. People really want to talk about that, in part because it's an understudied area of his writings, but in part also because Baldwin has for a long time been seen as this sort of prophet seer figure, right? And so people are looking to him like, well, what do we do? And so people keep coming back to it, and love for Baldwin was not the easy, sappy, sentimental romance love, right? It was very much about a hard reckoning. And that the rigor of love for Baldwin is similar to the Pentecostal rigor that we have here, where, you know, the way is a hard way. And I actually was hoping we would talk about this. So can we point to a certain spot here?
Yes, yeah. Of course, absolutely.
I'm on page 193. This is during Elizabeth's prayer, right? And she's talking about Richard, and she's talking about all the ways that they were happy together, right? So it says, they had been very happy together in the beginning, and until the very end, he had been very good to her, had not ceased to love her, and tried always to make her know it. No more than she had been able to accuse her father had she been able to accuse him. His weakness she understood, and his terror, and even his bloody end. What life had made him bear, her lover, this wild, unhappy boy, many another stronger and more virtuous man might not have borne so well. And that's a moment in which we see the sort of real tough love that Baldwin talks about. His famous thing is love is a battle, love is a war, love is a growing up. And to be able to see somebody, accept somebody, and love them for all of their failures, for all of the ways they cannot amount to what she needs from him. But she is still, clearly he was the love of her life, and she's not shy about that in this recollection. That is a very religious idea with a sort of capital R, right? If that makes sense.
I was just going to say also, and that also strikes me as just being very characteristic of the language of the Black Freedom Movement, right? Particularly Martin Luther King saying, you know, that, and I'm thinking of, you know, all those films that we have of SNCC training students to do the sit-ins, right? And they're saying, you know, these people are going to come to you and they're going to hurt you and they're going to push you off of your stools and all of that. And you have to endure this with love, because it's through that love that you will change their hearts and change society and bring about the kind of transformations that America needs, right? And so there is, I think, as you say, it's there are really religious and explicitly Christian overtones to a lot of this.
That makes me, what point did Martin Luther King and James Baldwin meet? How intertwined were their ideas? Or are they both coming out of the church tradition, or are these things that they're sharing?
Different church traditions, right? There's the Baptist tradition, and Baldwin's stepfather was a Baptist minister. And then once James Baldwin started to actively work for a church, it was a Pentecostal storefront church, very similar to this one here, right? I will say I'm terrible at dates, so I can't tell you exactly when they met. I'm embarrassed to say that. But they did have a number of interactions. But Baldwin's sexuality was kind of a problem for King, right? So that, I mean, he was invited to attend the March on Washington, not to speak. And, right, so to say that they got on well, sure, but there were a complicated amalgam of reasons why they weren't exactly in lockstep with each other, right? Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was just going to ask if Baldwin and Bayard Rustin had much of a relationship, because of course they were both gay.
Sure.
And that's kind of similar marginalization.
Who is Bayard Rustin? I'm afraid, I don't know.
Oh, Rustin was one of the major architects of the nonviolent protest movement, even going back before Martin Luther King.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was one of the main architects of the march and all kinds of stuff. He was a hugely important figure there. But similar to the way that Baldwin was sidelined for in that moment, I mean, a lot of people don't know who Bayard Rustin was. And that says a lot about the way history is taught and the occlusions of sexuality. In like, we could go on and on about that, right? But yeah, they certainly would have interacted and they would have met each other, but they were not. Again, they also weren't in lockstep, right? And part of this is that James Baldwin was in France from 1948 to 1957. And then he's in France or Switzerland. And then he spends a good chunk of time in the 60s, I want to say from 61 to 69, almost 10 years, where his permanent residence is in Istanbul, in Turkey. Right, James Baldwin is really the international transatlantic commuter. So he does come back to the United States. He comes, he visits the South. He has this sort of reporting tour where he works for the Congress of Racial Equality and he interviews a number of people. And so he's certainly there in these moments, but he is not a permanent resident in the way that he would have had these kinds of really formative relationships and been a real partner in a lot of these things.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think we were starting to talk a little bit about Gabriel, and I think Gabriel is very much tied up with sin. I mean, Gabriel's sort of this stand-in for the sexual sin that seems to plague a lot of the characters, but Gabriel's the one that clasps it and holds it like this millstone throughout the entire book. And when you were talking about Elizabeth and Richard and the love, this fierce love that she had for Richard, I was wondering, do we see that love for Gabriel? I mean, Elizabeth to some degree, but there always seems to be a disconnect. And I wonder, is that because this sin he can't let go?
I mean, Gabriel is just, he is such a clear stand-in for Baldwin's father, at least in the way that James Baldwin represented his father in other writings, right? That's important here, James Baldwin gets to have the word on this because he wrote it down, right? But he rather memorably said that, you know, his father was driven crazy by the fact that he believed all the terrible things white people said about him. And this is not a metaphorical. His father was institutionalized at the end of his life. He went insane, right? And partly this has to do with just the cruelty of the world that he and, by extension, Gabriel lives in, right? So very similarly, Baldwin's own stepfather comes up from New Orleans in the 20s, ends in Harlem, and finds that things aren't really all that much better. And, right, so Gabriel is a very cruel man. And in a way, his cruelty is it's a small moment for him to have some control over a life that he has very little control over. And he is also beset by his inability to be responsible. He is not able to properly feed his children. And he is not able to do the right thing by Esther and all, right? So his inability to face his own weaknesses really just undoes him. And the only thing he can do in response is to just visit that cruelty on others and take a shelter in a sort of veneer of religious respectability, right? And I will say that, just quick point back to Baldwin's ethic of love, right? What Gabriel lacks, what makes Gabriel so cruel, is his inability to really reflect and love in and of himself. He cannot admit that he is a failed man. And it tears him apart. To just say, I made a mistake, that's huge. Gabriel can't do that. He won't do that. And he visits all of the ramifications of that on everybody else, right? Yeah, I could go on and on about all the ways Gabriel's a terrible guy, right? But I mean, it's important to understand as well that, you know, we understand John Grimes by understanding Gabriel, right? Because while the story is about John's sort of salvation moment on his 14th birthday, he's coming to terms with his father just as much as he's coming to terms with some sort of heavenly God figure, right? So all of the ways that Gabriel's life has been impacted by the strictures of racism, right? And his movie's part of the Great Migration North, but yet turns out the North's not all that much better. I mean, there's explicit moments in the book where they say the North is not better than the South, right? And then he finds out all of these different, like, that's how John is able to come to terms with this. And yet Gabriel does not ever have those introspective moments. Why he can't, I
that's so interesting. And Doug, help me out with this, because you'll remember better from last week than I would, but it reminds me of one of the arguments that Baldwin made in that debate that we discussed last week, wherein he says, he points to, is it Jim Clark, the sheriff from Selma? And he says this racism that permeates our society is in many ways hurting him more than it is the Black population. And he goes through and he talks about, because of this man's inability to look inward, he's being corroded in some ways. And it actually makes me think of what you're talking about with Gabriel. Gabriel's inability to see himself, it's what destroying him. And in some ways, this is what Baldwin is also saying about, especially the white population in the South, their inability to see themselves is what's destroying them. Do you see any parallels between how he views Gabriel and how he's looking at part of the white society at this time?
I'll just mention, Christy, while we're on that point, the quote that Baldwin makes it was Sheriff Clark in Selma. He said, and I'm just reading this, he said, something awful must have happened to a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breasts, for example. What happens to the woman is ghastly, what happens to the man who does it is in some ways much, much worse. So that complexity, the way he's thinking about, as he describes it in that, I think in his writing, but also in, you know, on the Dick Cavett show and just all of those conversations he's having during that era about the complexity of race, he's talking about the identity crisis, and it's that white people that have subjugated black people are experiencing. It just seems deeply empathetic really fascinating. And I think a conversation that's so complex, that's really, Christy, you were mentioning this before, really valuable for now as we're all trying to make sense of it.
That's one of the things that marks Baldwin both as a thinker and a writer, is his ability to imaginatively inhabit these other viewpoints, right? I mean, his next novel, Giovanni's Room, comes out in 1956. And as I alluded to before, there's no recognizable African-American characters there. The main character is a white guy who leaves America to go to France, and he struggles with his sexuality there. The entire novel is told from the perspective of this pretty stereotypical straight white American man and his crisis of sexuality and identity, right? And then way later in his writings, in the 70s, If Beale Street Could Talk, the main character there is a young pregnant woman. Right. So Baldwin's ability to imaginatively be in that empathetic moment of other people's, you know, ideas and ideals of themselves is one of the things that marks him as such an important writer and thinker.
Just a question of curiosity, did he and his father ever have any kind of reconciliation? What was their relationship when his father passed away?
The really only reconciliation that he, James Baldwin, ever talked about was at about 16, 17, right before he left the church. His father says to him, "You would rather write than preach, wouldn't you?" And he says, "Yes." And he says, "That's the only moment in which my father and I really talked to each other." So yeah, no, they did not ever really come together.
I just had a comment. It may be a little off topic, but I was reading the novel, both of the wives of Gabriel, Deborah and Elizabeth, had these horrific, traumatizing experiences early on, and they both end up then marrying Gabriel, where the one woman who didn't seem to have that past traumatizing experience is the one that not gets away because she ultimately dies, but I was just wondering if there was some connection with Baldwin's mother as far as that goes, if you know, Gabriel was kind of representative of his father.
Yes and no. Yes, there is some representation there in that Elizabeth sort of tracks a little bit with Baldwin's mother's own life, in that James Baldwin was not living with his biological father, right? She had had him from another relationship. And, but in terms of some sort of main trauma or something like that, that you're sort of hinting at, we don't really know that much, because he only really referred to his mother with absolute love and reverence. There's way less about his mother than there is about his father.
It was just interesting that he was able to, I thought it was interesting with Elizabeth and Deborah, they both just had these horrific things happen to them. And I know probably a lot of Black women during that time did, but it just kind of struck me that those were two women that ended up with Gabriel.
Even Esther, who didn't have this troubled past, the horrific thing that happened to her was Gabriel. You know, I mean, she ended up having a child, and then that he would never claim, and she left and, you know, died. I mean, it's her own end is tragic, and honestly, it came at the hands of Gabriel, which he, at least as far as we see, never acknowledges.
Even when he's confronted by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Florence is, I think, my favorite character in the book, because she just pushes against him and pushes against him. And her own ending story was also surprising. You know, I think like John, a lot of us were like, no, run, you know, get out of there. Yeah. And yet she has her own melancholy and her own just difficulties. And going north was not the answer that she had hoped for either. And it really, in a way that it feels, it's that common man tragedy, her story is. It's not that there is a big tragic event that happens to her. It just, things just don't go right. And then she gets older, you know? That's how it ends for her in some ways.
And you had asked earlier about the sort of, you know, the structure of the book. And that's one of the things that really makes this book such a literary achievement is you get all of these layered stories. And you have John's story, which is the sort of frame tale, right? And then in between it, you have the prayers of all the different saints. And in those moments, we get all of these every man, every woman's stories, but yet they track and trace a great deal of really important African-American and American history, right? They're coming up north, they're part of the Great Migration, we're dealing with segregation, we're dealing with the Depression and the Jazz Age in Harlem going on at the same time outside of the house, right? There's an incredible amount of realist history built in these little moments of just in ordinary life.
Yeah. Well, any final questions for Dr. Joyce or any other points? I promised I'd keep this under an hour and we're getting that. I actually said 50 minutes and we're over that. So I don't want to take too much more time. But if anybody has any other questions or points, I'd love to hear them. I would love, Dr. Joyce, if you have other Baldwin recommendations for us. What would you recommend next? You know, Matt, you know, supposing that most of us are Baldwin newbies and we've read his first novel, then what?
I mean, certainly you could go in order, right? Giovanni's Room is a very compelling novel. I will say, just in terms of a reader perspective, I rather enjoy Another Country. It is a very complex novel. It's a little bit thicker, but it really has a ton going on for it. And there's a number of different characters, a number of different stories. It's very complex. But it's also not a terribly difficult read. Generally, if somebody says, what Baldwin book should I read? I usually say, if you're going to read the essays, start with The Fire Next Time or Notes of a Native Son. If you want to read a novel, Another Country or Go in Order.
Yeah. Do you have any parting comments on the film that came out, was it last year, If Bill Street Could Talk?
Oh, I mean, I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. Visually, it was super lush, and they just did such a good job of getting that, you know, the importance of a real in-depth personal relationship and Baldwin's notion of true love, right? In a way, it is a very beautiful novel. Even though it is a very painful novel about the problems of the American prison industrial system, the love between Tish and Fonny is very palpable in the novel. And the film does such a good job of it. I mean, they really, really, it's beautifully shot. So I was very impressed with the film, even though they did change the ending, which often gets people really upset. I was okay with the way they changed it. Like, sure, different, you know.
Well, thank you all so much for coming. Thank you for reading. This was what we talked to. This was not the beach read, you know, that you usually read in July. But I'm very, very glad we read it. It was a great read and a good intro for me, at least, to James Baldwin. But thank you all. Really appreciate it. Have a good night, everybody.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me, having me. This was awesome. I'm very pleased to be part of it.
That's Dr. Justin Joyce. He's managing editor of the James Baldwin Review, and Radio West executive producer Christy Miners. That was our July Radio West Book Club meeting, where we talked about Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin. If you're interested in becoming a member of the Radio West Book Club, just go to our website, radiowest.org, for more information. We'd love to have you join us for August. We're going to be reading a selection of short stories by the great horror and mystery writer Shirley Jackson. I'm Doug Fabrizio.